Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, it's primary day in Texas. Mitt Romney will be the nominee after today, won't he? Who will be the VP pick going into Tampa? And the soap opera in Wisconsin continues. Is Scott Walker going to win the battle but lose the war? What effects could this have on both sides of the aisle? Also, is capitalism under attack? After Cory Booker's comments, the Democrats go on the offensive. Christine Lagarde inserts her pied into her bouche. Should she be replaced? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And good afternoon. It is Tuesday here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in a unified, somewhat, edition of Backroom Politics. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District, former Vice President of Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, and welcome back.
Thank
corporally.
You. Corporally, it is. It is. It's nice to be home. Yeah. I got to tell you. Joining me to my 12 o'clock, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is longtime Washington insider, the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, hello.
It's good to be here, and it's good to have you back.
It is good to be back. And my chair seems like it's just here for me.
It was very lonely last week.
Here we go. And to my right, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He's a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He's Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm glad to be back with everyone here at Shelley's.
And joining us remotely, after coming off of a slight illness, he is the former chairman of the Democratic Party of Maryland. He's longtime Washington insider, Carl Thuvin. Carl, how you doing out there?
I'm doing okay, guys. I'm doing okay. Welcome back to the Warrior.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. And not here today, but for good reason, is our friend and longtime Washington insider and former Undersecretary of Commerce, who served various presidents. I think the final count is 4. And he is a very distinguished and very gentle fellow at the Stimson Center, and now the married fellow. He is the Honorable Undersecretary Alan Moore, who is celebrating his recent nuptials. Congratulations to the newlyweds. I hope you guys are enjoying. I hope you're not listening to the show. Hey, big stuff happening here in Washington. I'm glad I picked the right week to come back. Right now, what we've got here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics on the big screen, the president is, in fact, giving out the Presidential Medal of Freedom Awards, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But big news today, it's Texas. It is primary day in Texas, which means that we will finally, if you're a Republican, we'll have a nominee officially. Until you get to Tampa, then it'll be really official.
Does this mean that Gingrich is finally out?
Gingrich is finally out, Al. I know this is shocking.
For good.
let me rephrase that for legal reasons. He has suspended his campaign for president.
And I know you're disappointed.
I know you're shocking by this.
Well, I'm sorry.
But where there's lack of a green Gingrich, there's a Trump. And we'll talk about that too. But here's the big thing. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us at area code 619-638-8477. By the way, this will be the last week for this call-in number. Beginning next week, we are going to have a toll-free number to call in to Backroom Politics. True story. But if you want to join the conversation, anything happening inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, you can join us at area code 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Let's get right to it, guys. Texas primary day. That means that GOP Republicans throughout the grand state of Texas are going to the polls today to pretty much say, okay, I guess it's Mitt. They're not seen, they don't seem to be too excited down there, Al. Why?
Well, because it's Texas. and probably there's no place that Texans hate more than Massachusetts. So
That's
I think
true.
It's pretty you know, I'm surprised that he's going to win in Texas.
I mean, there's not much play. I mean, you know, Ron Paul obviously suspended his campaign, theoretically. We'll probably see some Paulites out there roaming the campuses of the different polling districts. However, Bob, when we look at Mitt Romney, I mean, we're starting to see everything come together. The attacks from the White House are starting to go after after Romney. Romney's attacks are starting to go directly at the president. Are we finally in general election mode here in the United States, Bob?
I would say we probably it's visible now. I think both candidates have been their friends and their allies and their people that they don't coordinate with, but coordinate with them, and whether they know it or not, it's been going on for a good 2 or 3 months, it seems to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the funny thing about it is, you know, when we look at the dynamics that are going on in the GOP right now, it just seems that this would have been normally a much more celebrated day of we have finally picked our presumptive nominee. We are finally in campaign mode, but Bob, am I misreading this? It just doesn't have the same feeling as it did maybe 8 years ago.
Well, it's been clear for some time that Mr. Romney was going to win. A combination of self-destruction on the part of the other candidates and underfunding of others and just weakness of them as a general group. It's been all along you had to beat Romney, and every once in a while somebody popped their head up, and then bang, you know, they got hit over the head with some reality check, and they disappeared. Bachman disappeared, Kane disappeared, the former speaker disappeared. You know, everybody.
The former governor of Texas.
Yeah, the former
Rick
governor
Perry.
Of Texas.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's just a matter of, I think most people have thought for at least 6 weeks that there was no one. It was just a matter of time.
Al, go ahead.
Well, I think that you can lay a lot of the blame or credit, depending on your point of view, at the feet of the Tea Party people. They came in and really stirred the Republicans up, and I think that Mitt Romney would have been a shoo-in in that field, although without them it may have been a stronger field. But he would have been a shoo-in otherwise. But now that he's finally got it settled, the right wing that probably caused the whole thing are not very happy about it, so they're off in their corner sulking. I would like to see the pouts.
Ralph.
Well, I think that's the major challenge now, is bringing the Tea Party people on board with the Romney campaign and ensuring that the number one goal being defeat Obama and not a fight among each other.
Bob.
I think it's going for the Tea Party people. I think it's going to be pretty easy for them to, you know, join with Romney's campaign and support him fully. They are probably the folks who are most unhappy with the president and his policies. And I think that all along it's been my thought that the Tea Party will come in behind him for the most practical reason at all. They don't want Mr. Obama to serve another 4 years, and Mr. Romney is the candidate who has survived, and they have a choice. They can either vote for Mr. Romney, or they're going to have Mr. Obama as president again.
Congressman Al.
Well, let me say this about that, as Richard Nixon used to say.
You're quoting Richard Nixon?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Okay, wait a minute. Stop the president.
Yes. Okay. I'm concerned for
I think he's had a head trauma.
I can't use all of the office, you know,
okay,
in public. You know, what I was trying to say, if I can remember what it was,
This is great. We're off to a rolling start here on Backroom Politics. This is why people listen. This makes for great radio. His amnesia fits make for great radio.
You were going to quote Nixon. Know, whenever I'm winning an argument, interrupt me. And Nixon was unimportant. I did it to myself with that little parenthetical. I get tripped up by parenthetical expressions. Or as they used to say on Saturday Night Live, never mind.
There you go. Okay. Good point, Al. With Mitt Romney has obviously got a challenge. He's obviously got something that, you know, that is concerning the true base of the GOP. That is electability in his own base. I don't think that the problem is with the independents. I think the independent voters are probably more prone to, based on his record in Massachusetts. Am I right, Bob?
Well, I believe that's true. The independents, I think, are probably comfortable with Romney, no matter how much yelling back and forth we've had over the last few months. The fact of the matter is, while he is a conservative in his basic principles, he is not a right winger. And I think, you know, that's why the Tea Party folks have been somewhat slow to come around. But the fact of the matter is, they have no other choice unless they want Obama, and they are going to, and if they are enthusiastic and if they're willing to come out, I think it'll help him a lot.
Ralph, go ahead.
I think the one wrinkle in all of this is the whole issue with the Obama birth certificate and the birther movement and how much of an influence that has on the Tea Party, because I think Romney is going to have to come out and address that issue, given what Trump has been saying, and just tell the people, say, look, you know, if you don't like the guy, work with us, and let's defeat him in November. And I think he takes that issue right off the table.
Does it take the issue off the table, Adam?
If I were Obama, I wouldn't let him take it off the table.
Why not?
It is one of the most ridiculous charges I've ever seen drag on as long as that one has. You have to be an idiot to believe a conspiracy theory such as that. And I think that if Romney doesn't address that in a way that doesn't use those words but says it's not true, then I think he's got trouble with moderates because he's embracing an idiotic idea.
Well, hey, Carl, I mean, from a state party perspective, I mean, the more and more this birther movement gets credibility, that's got to make the Dems pretty happy.
Yeah, I think it does. And also, I think the Tea Party going to Romney has pluses and minuses. There are a lot of people in the country who either know or will know by election day what the Tea Party has done, the obstruction that they've done in Washington, the tearing apart the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, and they are partly responsible for pushing us to the edge in the debt ceiling debate from months ago. And I think that some of their antics have just been abominable. And when people start to focus on what they've done, I think it's going to hurt the Republican cause. And all these Tea Party candidates who mysteriously get money in the last 24 hours and defeat more moderate Republicans are opening the door for good Democratic challenges. And especially in the Senate, and you know, we might be able to keep the Senate majority because of what they're doing out in the hustings.
But Bob, looking at everything that's in play right now, is the Tea Party? I mean, because we're seeing some of the effects of the Tea Party. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening down in Texas in some congressional races, where the Tea Party is actually swinging a pretty big sword. But is the Tea Party lost its luster from, let's say, 4 years ago or even 2 years ago?
It might not have happened yet, but I think by the time the election comes along, and if it becomes an issue of what has contributed and what have they not contributed, I think it could become a very big issue in the minds of some independent voters and others.
Bob, what do you think?
I think that's possible, but again, when you get down to presidential politics, it's the two people that you've got to choose between. And no matter how much either side argues, you know, our guy's better than your guy because of this or that policy or this or that thing they've done or not done, it fundamentally comes down to who you want in the White House, and I think that's is going to be the big issue, and nothing else is going to be as important.
Al,
I think also that I agree substantially with what Vince said, but I think that's a battle that the Democrats should fight out at the congressional level. I don't think it's going to stick in the presidential debate. But I think it's a beautiful argument for a Democrat or a moderate Republican to make at the congressional and senatorial level.
Is the congressional level? I mean, can the Tea Party focus just at the congressional level, Bob?
Yeah, that's where they really are. And but not just let's just step back a minute and talk about something that has come up recently. Grover Norquist is a guy who has spent his career getting members of Congress and candidates for Congress, most all Republicans, to sign a pledge saying they won't vote for any increase in revenues. What's interesting is that members of Congress, who are most of them in their freshmen, in their early years, are now, who have signed the pledge, are now going public and saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not bound by that. I'm going to exercise my best judgment. And some of those folks, strangely enough, are in fact Tea Party folks who got elected on small governments, but they recognize there is, if you're going to solve the problems of the domestic entitlement programs, the debt ceiling, and the economy, you're going to have some revenue someplace. And they're saying, in effect, I'm no longer bound by that pledge because I can see the need for revenues as long as we get cuts in other programs.
Congressman Al.
And at least some of them have got to be saying that people didn't vote for me in order for me to hand my vote over to anybody.
Exactly.
Grover Norquist or anybody else. That I need to exercise that because that's what I was elected to do, and I think that reasoning is going to start surfacing.
Well, we're starting to see a lot of people, like when we talk about the Grover Norquist effect in the Tea Party into the general electorate. Grover Norquist seems to be losing traction. We're starting to see people. I mean, some pretty senior people, Senator Tom Coburn out of Oklahoma, for example, has pretty much come out and said, "Look, I'm not signing my life away to this. This is done." And are we starting to see a more moderate Tea Party, Ralph?
I think the issue is people are telling their members of Congress, look, we want you to get things done over there. We don't want this kind of obstructionism. We don't want you tied down to special interests. And this is why you're seeing senators like Tom Coburn and others that are starting to fight back a little bit.
Al, you agree?
Yeah, and I think that not only does an institution like Grover Norquist, a recent institution, may be losing ground, but I see the very, very, very beginnings of what would worry me like crazy if I were the NRA. And that is that cities have started, at the behest of their police chiefs, to start keeping files on people who commit crimes with guns. Now, it's gun registration, which they've always been against. It's not what usually is thought of as gun registration, but they're writing down the names of people who break the law with a gun. And that could be a crack in what has been a very, very solid bull.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about what's going on down in Texas. Mitt Romney will have enough delegates today to walk into Tampa with the nomination, on top of the fact there's also a Veep discussion going on. But this is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. And today, we are unveiling you know, we've been playing jazz and there's never been any advertising. We now have advertising. Our advertiser is our sole backer, Shelley's Back Room, but allow me to introduce our first Backroom Politics ad. You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Back Room, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Back Room has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion.
I have a question.
Yes, you do.
When do I get a sandwich named after me?
When you spend as much money as I do in this joint,
oh. You
too can have a sandwich named after you.
Oh.
Al, you're going to have to work real hard to get
it. You are going to have to work real hard. You are going to work real hard to do that, sir. Funny story about that sidebar before we go back to the political discussion. My accountant was going through my taxes, and I was writing off business expenses because I spend a lot of time in here for business. That's no secret. But he calls me up one day, and he goes, "Are you high?" I go, "What do you mean?" They go, are you insane? I go, "What are you talking about?" They go, "You're spending X amount of thousands of dollars a year in a strip bar?" I went, "What are you talking about? Shelley's Back Room. You're spending X amount of money in a strip club?" Wait, no, it's a cigar bar. Then it's perfectly fine, and I can write it off.
Right.
So, but we digress. The big thing that we're talking about, what's happening down in Texas, where today Mitt Romney will have officially enough delegates to claim the Republican Party nomination for President of the United States in November. But it does beg the question, though. Even though he does have enough delegates, we have seen a lot of things going down where Ron Paul is not going out down without a fight, per se. We talked about it quickly the last time where I was at the actual Oklahoma Republican convention where a fight broke out. They actually started hitting each other. And this was the political establishment of the Republican Party versus Ron Paul people. And the guy they escorted out was like an 85-year-old guy. I was shocked that an 85-year-old guy hit some young kid. He did. But the Ron Paul factor, is Ron Paul going to be an actual hindrance to the party come Tampa? Bob?
I don't believe he is. If you followed the relationships of the presidential candidates over the last 4 or 5 months, the one thing you saw, and it has been reported, I think, a little bit, is that Paul has been very helpful, very supportive to Mr. Romney. I think he feels that he's a good candidate. If Paul can't get the nomination, I think he'd rather have Paul than he'd rather have Romney than anybody else. And I don't know what the numbers are right now, but I suspect that Paul, who's usually getting 15% of the vote or so, it isn't a great number, but he may have as many delegates as any candidate except Romney at this point.
Al?
I have always felt that it's not going to be that simple. I don't think that Ron Paul plans to blow up the Republican convention, but he is going to make some demands, whether that is on some platform issues or whether it's that and a speaking place in prime time.
But is that really a bargaining chip anymore? I remember the times growing up as a child, 30 years ago, where we would watch. I mean, it was wall to wall coverage of the conventions. Now it's kind of you catch on CNN
it's 2 or 3 hours a night at most.
Yeah, is that really a bargaining chip, Al?
If Ron Paul demands his time in that 2 or 3 hours, which if I were he, I would do that. And then the concern is he going to say something that Romney will have to spend time apologizing for or separating himself from, whatever.
And I think that's the challenge for the Republican National Committee, is how are they going to integrate him into the convention without embarrassing the nominee?
I think there is no reason that Ron Paul is going to do anything that is going to be seriously harmful to the Republican Party as long as the party is smart enough to let him have a little bit of room.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
But how much leeway are they going to give Ron Paul?
Well, let's say you get 20 minutes or half hour one of the evenings to make a major speech.
What about on the platform?
Well, I don't know what he might want, but if I suspect that the platform is going to suit Mr. Romney.
But I
don't think there's going to be any.
Isn't there a problem if they give Ron Paul around and deal with Newt Gingrich, Santorum, Mr. Pizza, and others?
Say that again, Carl. I'm sorry.
If they give Ron Paul 20 minutes, aren't they going to have to deal with the other primary candidates who also would be looking for some speaking assignment at the convention?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, let's look at that. I mean, Bob, you've been involved in numerous Republican conventions. You were the parliamentarian at three of them. Does the NRC have an issue of if we give one to all that the other candidates might call fair and equal time?
I don't think you're going to have to give everybody time. No, I don't believe that.
Gingrich.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't give Gingrich time.
What about Santorum?
Yeah, I would think Santorum will get some time.
I think you've got Santorum.
Yeah. He'd be the only. Santorum and I think Santorum and Paul are the only two who will get time.
Because they have delegates in many of the delegations, including Hawaii. So there's going to be a push to get them some time on the national spotlight.
They have delegates, and they managed to carry out their campaigns with Santorum at the end rather gracefully without hurting Romney.
And Paul
hasn't been beaten up on
Paul
Romney.
Paul has not done anything at all publicly or, you know, during the debates that hurt Romney.
And none of the other candidates have any bargaining chip with Romney.
Including a Rick Perry who, arguably, you may need Rick Perry to help deliver taxes.
Possibly.
Does Perry have a leg to stand on when it comes to that?
I don't believe so.
Al?
No.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to have any trouble taking Texas anyway. But
no. Yeah, I think Texas is...
We'll know more after this primary exactly what Perry is going to want.
Well, you know,
forward.
But I mean, the reality is that, you know, as we're looking forward towards Tampa, the other big question as far as who's going to get time is who could be, A, the big keynote, and B, who's going to be the VP selection? Let's talk about the keynote. The keynote tends to be something very, very dramatic. It tends to be something, somebody either an up-and-coming rising star or somebody of great national significance that will drive people to the party. Bomb, yeah. NRC, who's that person this year?
Well, if you take a look at who are the best speakers, the most energetic people, I would say that... the governor of New Jersey is not an unlikely choice.
Chris Christie.
Yeah.
What about somebody like a Tim Pawlenty?
I don't think he could get people standing up and screaming and yelling and carrying on. He's not a dynamic speaker.
Condoleezza Rice.
She is not a dynamic speaker either, I don't believe.
Marco Rubio would be a logical choice.
I would think he may have some speaking
but
time.
But Marco Rubio is also in the fold for V, too.
But so is the governor of New Jersey.
Yeah.
So is Chris Christie, arguably. Yeah. Is this year's keynote possibly a sign or a view of what might be the ticket?
Yeah.
Al, why?
Well, the one... candidate of all those that are talked about for vice president that bothers me as a Democrat who would like to see Obama win is Chris Christie.
Why?
Because he offsets the stiffness of the main candidate, Romney. He talks more blue collar than he does, than Romney does. He's not in any philosophical conflict with Romney over anything in particular, and I think he could be the guy in the campaign that's doing the rah-rah stuff while Romney does what he does better, which is to talk very seriously.
Carl Tuvin is a former chair of the Democratic Party of Maryland. Does Chris Christie bother you?
I don't think it doesn't bother me, but I don't think Chris Christie wants it at this point. I know it's tradition that the presidential candidate asks you to come on the ticket, you come on the ticket. But I think he's really looking down the road. I think he really wants to do what he's doing in New Jersey and build a record and looking forward to 2016 when he might want to run.
Bob,
I could be wrong. Now, I think he would be a good keynoter. And, you know, there's also a problem sometimes with keynoters. In 1976, John Glenn was thought to be the person who would run with Jimmy Carter. And as you remember, Barbara from Texas gave a beautiful keynote speech. And when John Glenn came by, I looked at him, I said, good luck. But I knew after the keynote speech that Barbara Jordan gave that he couldn't fit the bill. And he was knocked out of being the nominee.
Interesting. Right. Ralph.
I was going to say, I think given the whole war on women issue that has plagued Republicans, they should probably have a woman as one of the keynote speakers as a way to attract.
Is K. Bailey Hutchison that person, Bob?
You mean as far as the speaker goes?
As far as
the
keynote goes.
Right, to attract the women and independents.
I think that she could be.
I've never heard her speak.
No, I have. I haven't either. So I, you know, it depends on.
Yeah, I mean, she's. I mean, Kay Bailey Hutchison is a great speaker. I mean, KBH has always been a very prolific speaker. She speaks well.
Well, then she is the kind of a person they're going to want. What they're going to want there is somebody who, you know, gets everybody excited. Not only the delegates on the floor, but the audience who's listening on television. They're going to want somebody who, you know, who says, let's go get them. And that's what they're going to need. And Christie is a person like that, I know. If you're telling me that Kay Bailey is of that ilk, that I think having a woman do it would be excellent.
What about Christy Noem from South Dakota?
Nikki Haley from South Carolina?
North Carolina.
South Carolina.
Yeah.
You're right. Those would
be good choices.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of choice. But is the women issue with the Republicans right now that big of an issue that they would want a female keynote speaker, Bob?
Well, I don't know that it has to be the keynote, but I think it's important to have at least one woman prime time making a major statement, and I think that's going to be expected. I think that
Romney has got some problems with women, and I think the Republicans have some problems with women. I think it'd be brilliant to have Kay Bailey Hutchison do it.
Remember also that Kay Bailey Hutchison is retiring after this term, so that, you know, it's, I'm not sure that that's the right person to project. She's probably a good speaker, and she would do well. But she is going to retire from public life.
Well, I think the thing about what you want in a keynoter is someone who excites the audience, both in the room and in their homes. I think that's the key thing for a keynoter, and I suspect that whoever they pick will be able to make it stick, make a strong statement for the party and the policies of the candidate.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. When we come back, though, I want to talk a little bit about the V ticket. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back. You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., as being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the side of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Backroom, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion of what's going on today in Texas and what's going on in the GOP as the GOP continues to seek its final ticket to go head-to-head with Obama-Biden. We were talking last about the importance of the keynote speaker for the GOP this year. Let's talk about the VP ticket. Bob, who is on your top list? Who do you think's in play right now?
I think that Portman's in play.
Rob Portman?
Yes, Senator Portman from Ohio.
Right.
I think he's in play for the reason that Mr. Romney has not spent much time in Washington. Mr. Portman's, most of his career has been here. He served, I think, either 5 or 6 terms in the House of Representatives. He is now a senator. He has absolutely no known enemies in the Congress. He is a deal maker. He is smart. He's been the trade operator for the United States. He has been the head of the OMB. He knows budgeting.
He'd be kind of a Joe Biden. What Joe Biden is to Obama.
Exactly.
A trusted advisor in the Oval Office.
He would be an excellent vice president. He has one, I would say, not a failing, but one limitation, and that is he's much like the candidate himself, like Mr. Romney. He is not much of a rah, 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 you know, jump up and down. He's a fairly quiet speaker and a quiet guy, but he's very forceful in what he says and how he says it.
Who else?
I think Mr. Christie.
What about, one name?
And let me say about Christie, I think what Carl said is true. I think Christie may not want it, but...
I tend to agree.
And I happen to think if I were Mr. Christie, I wouldn't want it anyway. This is not his... I mean, this ruins one of his opportunities for the
presidency. He's biding his time for 2016.
Exactly. Well, I think that, and
I think he's in play.
Right. He probably is in play. I'll tell you right now, I personally don't think that Chris Christie is in play as the media likes to put it out there. I think Chris Christie still has to make his bones in New Jersey. I think he is eyeing 2016. I think that the reality still dictates that, as he said numerous times, including in the press conference where he said, I'm not running for president, he said, now's not my time. He is very self-aware. One name that keeps popping up as a dark horse candidate is the Republican governor from Arizona, Jim Brewer. Mm-hmm. Is Jim Brewer in play, do you think, Al?
Well, I honestly don't know. I think that anyone from Arizona with her record on
immigration
is going to give fits to the Hispanic voters.
It would be too polarizing.
Yeah, I think she is not in play. If you're looking for a woman, there's the governor of New Mexico.
Right.
Susana Martinez.
Susana Martinez.
And Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, because I think as a vice presidential candidate,
yes.
I think she's very credible. Where we agreed she wasn't as a keynote speaker.
But is Condoleezza Rice the right play? And would she play in that role? That's the big question. I mean, when we look traditionally, and Carl, I want to go to you, is the former Secretary of State the right person in the right place at the right time for the GOP? Carl? I think we've lost Carl.
Okay.
Call back in.
Yeah, call back in, Carl. And, you know, when we look at, Condoleezza Rice, Bob will pose a question to you. Is this the right time? Is this the right play for her right now?
Well, I think that she is definitely in play. I think she is very smart. She has a good record, public record. And I think that the fact that she is both a woman and an African American, I think, is very useful to the party. And she is she's an attractive speaker. She's good on her feet, and she'd
beef up foreign policy, which
strongly,
has a lot of experience.
And I think she would be a good strong candidate.
and you're right, on foreign policy, she's very effective at dealing with the Chinese and the Russians, which is going to be very important in the years ahead.
What about the governor of your old state, Ohio?
Which governor?
You mean Kasich?
Kasich. No.
No?
No, I don't think so.
Why not? His name's been mentioned around a couple of times.
He is a little bit of a loose cannon.
That was so gently put. I was trying to figure out how I could say the same thing and make it acceptable, and I couldn't think of one.
Here's a wild card. What about Carly Fiorina?
Oh, no, I would venture to say that's probably a...
You want to talk about polarizing?
Okay. No way. She's right. Coming with a lot of baggage from her days over at HB.
And,
okay.
And the presidential candidate doesn't need beefing up in terms of his corporate experience.
And not HB. When she was CEO out in Silicon Valley, I will tell you right now that one of the players that I think also keeps coming up. Is the former governor of Indiana,
Mitch Daniels.
Yeah. But it begs the question: when we talk about Mitch Daniels, when we talk about current governor Mitch Daniels, when we talk about VP candidates, when we talk about Mitch Daniels, when we talk about Rob Portman, when we talk of those types of possibilities. It then goes back to the grand old party of old white guys. Can the GOP survive a white guy ticket in this round, Bob?
I suppose I would say yes, it's possible. No, it's most of the time, what you want in your vice president, traditionally you say the big thing is, can he bring his or her state, the vice presidential candidate. I'm not so sure that is as important as it used to be.
I think
quite frankly, what Mr. Romney needs in his vice president is someone who understands and knows Washington and has relationships here, because Mr. Romney has not spent much time at all in Washington, doesn't know a lot of the major players, and of course, if you're the president, you'll meet them very quickly.
But theoretically, neither did Governor George Bush. Al, what do you think?
Well, but look who George Bush had for his vice president. He was picking people who know Washington.
Right. Al, true. Al, what do you think?
I think it's very dangerous to have a ticket with no one with Washington, D.C. experience. Jimmy Carter didn't pay enough attention to his vice president, and he had his Georgia mafia that thought they knew everything, and look what happened to him. I don't think that would be the way to go.
Really?
What about a moderate as your vice president?
Well, Bob, you're going to comment?
Well, I come right back to Portman. If you're looking for somebody who understands Washington, who has served both in administrations and an elected office, who has had major responsibilities, who has absolutely friends on both sides of the aisle in both houses, he is the kind of person who could be very helpful to a candidate like Mr. Romney, whose awareness of the intricacies of Washington's interplay is probably not very strong because he's never spent much time here.
But Carl, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Carl, does a Romney-Portman ticket actually kind of give the Democrats a little bit of a, ooh, well, that's interesting, but we'll still take the White House?
Well, it's kind of a... I don't know how to put this, kind of a no-faith kind of person, there, but he wouldn't overshadow Romney. Don't know what kind of a campaigner he is and what kind of a speech he gives. But I think you know, it might work, but who knows? Who knows? But and the thing is he conservative enough for the conservative and for the Tea Party people? You got to remember that that's a big part of the equation, as you well know.
That's a very good question, Bob. Is he conservative enough to get the base?
I think he is. And again, let's remind ourselves of one thing. If the Tea Party folks want one thing, they want to retire the president. And I believe that that is more important to them than anything else.
So the Obama must go mantra is more important than two white guys on a ticket.
I think so.
Al, you agree?
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting take. When we look at some of the outside the Beltway players, I mean, because a lot of these names that are being bantered around are outside the Beltway players. Whether you talk about somebody, a long shot like a Nikki Haley or a Jan Brewer. When you talk about when you talk about Marco Rubio, although currently seated in the Senate, basically a lot of his experience is down in Tallahassee as a state legislator. Is Rubio the right pick, do you think, Bob?
No, I don't think he thinks he's the right pick either. I think he thinks his time will come. He's only, 39 years old?
Right.
He doesn't have to worry. He doesn't have to think about it today.
Al, what do you think?
I think that if I were in the Republican Party and dealing with this, I would suggest to people an awful lot of presidents who came here with no D.C. experience and no real support, Jimmy Carter being one, and failed miserably. Richard Nixon, of all people, if you go back, his first 2 years as president were a disaster. And he surrounded himself with Haldeman, Ehrlichman, a bunch of people who didn't know this city, didn't like this city, and he got into deep trouble. Ronald Reagan ran against this city and then proceeded to hire as his key people every major intelligent Republican in the town who had experience, and he floated in as smooth as glass.
I.e., like a baker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let me throw this out. Where would you put John Huntsman in the equation?
Not even governor.
Not even
close.
I mean, it's not going to be vice president, but he would have some role in the Romney administration.
I think that Huntsman has done so much damage in his relationship with the Romney campaign that I don't think he's even a consideration right now. We won't even see him in Tampa, I don't believe. If we did, I'd be shocked.
There are a couple of delegates for him in D.C. and a couple of the other states.
Maybe.
So.
Final question on this when we look at it is there somebody in play that comes with completely no baggage? Because it seems to me that the Romney camp is trying to fight the whole Bain Capital thing, which we'll talk about in the top of our next hour. But is there somebody that could actually come in clean and be vetted as clean?
Do you mean clean enough that the Democrats can't create baggage for them?
clean enough that if the Democrats create baggage, it's not going to be a distraction, i.e. Marco Rubio and his heritage, i.e. Nikki Haley and some of the political dealings she did in South Carolina to get the governor's mansion, i.e. Jan Brewer and her immigration standpoint. Is Portman clean enough that he may be the one because he's sterile?
Well, I don't think his problem is that that he's too clean. I don't think there's anybody in this town who's worked with him who doesn't have respect for him.
Anybody that's cast as many votes as a person with long experience in Congress, the negative research people will find something, and you can't avoid it.
Well,
but the fact of the matter is, if you go back and look at his record, it's a conservative, but a moderate conservative record.
But won't that hurt him with the Tea Party movement?
I don't think so, for the reason that I've said already to many times. They want to win so badly,
okay.
You know, they'll take Santa Claus if that's what it takes to beat to beat the president.
So they'll overlook the fact that he worked across party lines.
They want to win.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Santa Claus is a white man, it would probably be acceptable.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Where's Alan Moore? Where's Alan to kind of counterpick this as a counterweight? Good Lord. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, it will be happy hour. We're going to order our drinks and cut another cigar and get ready for the home stretch. When we come back, we're going to talk about the attack on capitalism and how Bain Capital and Solyndra, and it looks like the free market economy is under attack by the Democrats. Sorry, Al. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays. Back Room for the second half of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion in our first hour. We're going to talk about the recent challenges that the free market economy system that we have here in the United States. Apparently, the Democrats decided it might be a little talking point, if you will, in the upcoming presidential run. Namely, we're talking about the Obama attacks on Bain Capital, as well as the Romney attacks on Solyndra. It's a back and forth. Let's talk about first the Obama attacks on Bain Capital. It is something that's drawn a lot of media attention recently here in Washington, basically because of the fact that Obama has come out and said that Bain Capital kills jobs. Bain Capital goes in there for their own private worth, and they're only interested in making money, and that makes Bain Capital and the fact that Mitt Romney a bad human being. Al, this actually sparked a kind of a little bit of a revolt in the party, i.e. by Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker, longtime ally of the Obama camp. He actually came out and said, look, the attacks on capitalism, the attacks on Bain Capital and other venture capitalists, they are not good attacks. They are good economic sources of growth in our free market system. Is Cory Booker right for calling out the Obama administration for attacking venture capitalism?
Well, I don't think so. I think that there are some local reasons for that.
Why are there local reasons? Because of his proximity to New York City?
Yeah. And it wasn't one of the companies that they helped out, a New Jersey company?
Correct.
So mayors and what have you that are working on economic development are not going to be happy with with what is perceived as an anti-business position. And I think that the Democrats and the president is not really handling this properly. I think the Democrats always overdo their attacks on business, just as I believe the Republicans always overdo their defense of the free enterprise system. They basically say anything that you do in the free enterprise system is okay, and we all know that's not true. In fact, the free enterprise system is going to be driven by the lowest common denominator, the biggest crook in the business or something, without some regulation. And if you're an honest businessman trying to do it right, pay your people properly and provide the things, and you've got somebody else in your field in the marketplace who is undercutting all of that, you have no real alternative but to lower yourself to that level in order to compete. So the free enterprise system, and I am a total free enterpriser, but I think that by saying you're for free enterprise, you are buying into the fact there's got to be some regulation. And there's a lot of Republicans that would disagree with that. But I think it puts the Democrats in a position of saying we are for free enterprise, which is good, and then they can defend regulation in a rational way rather than just saying because they're all big bad boogeymen, which I think is not true and is not a particularly good political attack.
But Bob, looking at how this all plays out, I mean, Cory Booker literally came off the reservation in his comments on Meet the Press a week ago Sunday,
yep,
where he actually said that coming out this way against, you know, part of the economic engine that drives this economy does not make sense for the president and will end up biting him in the rear end. Now, he has since retracted that statement, or at least backtracked a little bit, but he got slapped down pretty hard by the Obama administration, Bob. Is Cory Booker now on the outside?
Well, not being on the inside of Democratic politics, I have no idea. But I will say
he's not important enough to be
really.
No. But you know, I think in one sense, the attack on Bain and the free enterprise system, if you will, that the Democrats that the president is doing, I'm glad it came out as early as it has, because I think the earlier it comes out, the more people are going to be able to say, look, everybody understands that some companies are going to fail and some companies aren't. And when a company fails for whatever reason, you know, bad advertising or not enough, or a product that has been bypassed in the advance of technology, that company goes away. And that has been true as long as there's been a free enterprise system in this country. I would remind ourselves, 110 years ago, how many automobile companies do you think there were? There were about 100 making cars, you know.
Studebaker.
Most of them went away because they weren't building a product that the public wanted. The reality is that's the way it works. But the point is, you're going to get a lot more jobs with a free enterprise system that is dynamic and building the things that people want than you are that having a static system that doesn't move rapidly enough to be competitive, not only in this country, but around the world.
Carl, is the president coming out against Bain Capital a bad move for the Democrats, do you think?
You know, I'm amazed that they've done it in the way that they've done. It's explained by the fact that they want to paint Romney as this person who has created all these jobs, but in reality he hasn't created all these jobs. There was an ad about a steel company where when the fact checkers came in, they found out they had called Romney the head of Bain at the time. He wasn't the head of Bain at the time. I'm really kind of amazed that they've done this so early, and I think they've done it so early because they think that if they can do this and it sticks, that people are going to have this idea about him, and it's going to sit in their mind. But it could be too early.
Ralph.
What's interesting in this presidential race is that for the first time you have an incumbent president, and President Obama, being radically outspent by a challenger, Romney. And this has caused Mitt Romney's favorability ratings, which were at a lowly 37%, to now be at 50%, and they've been going up. And the Democrats feel they have to hit Romney where they think it hurts, and that's his ability to run a company and create jobs. But this is starting to backfire because, as Carl said, Romney was not even president of Bain at that time, and people are sort of starting to look through it.
I mean, Bob, is this sloppy political work by the White House?
Yeah, I think they made a big mistake in coming out so early and so hard against the free enterprise system. It's stupid to attack what drives this country's. Economic strength, its ability to create product that is all over the world. People are looking for American products, and they're buying their cars, they're buying their technologies, they're doing everything they can. It's good stuff. We make good stuff. Now, does every company exist? No. Their companies got, look, a few years ago, who was it? Hewlett-Packard was a superpower in technology. Look at now. They've had a couple of really tough years. They missed some product that they didn't do well with. They made bad product. Now, it someone else moves ahead of them.
But when we look at, like, for example, you know, the flip side of this is the Romney attacks on the White House for Solyndra. You know, is attacking Solyndra the right thing? I mean, granted, there were some political questions that were involved in that, but the reality is. Is the government investing or, you know, encouraging other private capital to invest in alternative energy sources, is that necessarily a bad thing when it comes to instituting a strong R&D effort in this country, Bob?
No, I think it's important to have a strong R&D factor. I think the problem with the Solyndra deal was that this was something that was, you know, looked kind of shady, or shady's unfair. It was questionable technology, and
there were questionable practices done by the White House.
Yeah, and they were so interested. They are so interested in new green technologies that they in effect, without knowing what they were getting into, I believe. I don't believe there's anything nefarious about it. They just didn't have enough talent inside to know, was this something that could be was good and ready to be made, or is it something that's too early? They haven't got their technology down, and that's exactly where they are. We wasted $1 billion.
Yeah, but Carl, real quickly though, I mean, this seems like, you know, in a campaign where you look at you've got David Axelrod running the show, this is really sloppy for somebody of the caliber of David Axelrod.
Well,
right, and he came out and he evidently has led the charge on this whole thing on Bain. And but you know, let me tell you, there's both sides have thrown barbs at one another. I mean, the Republicans keep saying that the Democrats are anti-business. Here that we're anti investment, and we're not anti-investment. We have put programs through the Department of Energy to try to make us more energy independent. Then they come along and say, well, you're anti-business because EPA has all these rules. Well, we're pro-business, but we're anti-fouling up the environment. And if we don't start dealing with environmental matters, we're going to go down the tubes, and the world's going to go down the tubes. And the world could be a place to live.
Ralph, well, the problem with Solyndra was they did not properly qualify the company to see if the technology was actually something that could be reasonably implemented. They gave it to a political connection, and it reeked of an inside politics thing. And that's the worst thing you could have in an area or technology that is growing all over the world that we need to invest money into to help expand and grow our economy.
Yeah, but Al, I go to you and I ask the question I asked Carl too. Is it surprising to you as a Democrat that David Axelrod and the political machine that they've got there in Chicago would be this sloppy about the handling of both the Solyndra issue and the Bain Capital issue?
Well, no, not after they completely blew a great opportunity while Wall Street was acting up and misbehaving. I never understood why the Democrats in Congress and the administration didn't make a very clear-cut case against what can happen in the free enterprise system if you get a bunch of people that just get out of control and don't abide by the rules and are willing to risk the economy of the country. They didn't make that case. They talked about it, but they didn't effectively solder that case in the minds of the American electorate. Had they, then I think they could say almost anything they wanted about Bain Capital and what have you, and it would stick. But they didn't.
Yeah, but you're going against big Obama backers like the head of J.P. Morgan.
I'm sorry.
The problem, David Axelrod, you're right. He is what he does as well as anybody. But he probably has as much understanding and knowledge about what Solyndra was doing as I do, which is zero. You know, the fact of the matter is they made mistakes in areas where they were making decisions that they didn't have enough expertise to make those decisions,
mm-hmm.
or enough knowledge to make those decisions. But in any event, they did, you know, they took a shot, and I think we're going to hear more of that kind of stuff on the Republican side coming in, talking about, I mean, you can really say, I mean, you can say maybe, well, there are some companies that Bain Capital, you know, died after they bought them for one reason or another because they were just not making the product that people want. That's one thing. It's something else to start pouring money into a technology you don't know if it's going to work. There are political friends and political decisions involved, and suddenly they spend $1 billion on something that doesn't work.
Interesting take. Interesting comments. This is obviously something that's going to be coming up in the presidential election,
mm-hmm.
coming up leading into November. But Al, go ahead.
I would suggest that 6 weeks from now, we will be talking about other issues, not these issues.
More than likely, right. As we get closer to the conventions in Charlotte and Tampa.
You can only wring so much political advantage out of either of these issues.
Is this sponge drying up for the Obama administration and for Romney?
Is it what?
Is this sponge drying up?
Oh, I think I don't know that it is now. It will. And they're going to have to find some other attack dog, and they will.
They will.
Good take.
I disagree with that, only because Priorities USA has done interviews with people affected by Bain, and they've unearthed the fact that there were several suicides. So you're going to have the Obama campaign really pushing this from an emotional standpoint to get people sympathetic towards Obama. So.
All right. I'll let that be the last word. We'll obviously be keeping an eye on this. When we come back, we're going to go a little bit off the reservation. We're going to talk about an international story that's starting to continue to develop. That's the situation in Syria. It is a tragic situation. At some point, somebody's got to get involved. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu. The most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
On Blog Talk Radio. We're going to talk about a very serious subject that's happening overseas right now. That's the situation in Syria. Friday, it was reported that a tremendous humanitarian crisis is evolving in the country of Syria. The Assad government is just wreaking havoc on its civilian population, and to the tune of women and children, over 100 dead on Friday, in what could be arguably called a massacre, a political massacre. The Assad government has come back and said that it was the opposition that did it to itself, which that water is not holding in the bucket very well, as demonstrated by an emergency UN Security Council meeting handled on Sunday, in which the Security Council came back and condemn the Syrian government for their actions. Real quickly, internationally, this is a tremendous situation, Ralph,
right.
Where we're seeing the Assad government is just basically thumbing its nose. Can this continue in Syria without international ramification?
Well, I think it's clear that the peace plan that's been negotiated by Kofi Annan and several members of the UN has not been working. The good news is that Russia...
Well, the international community is calling the former Secretary General's peace plan a sham.
Right. The plan is not working. The good news is that the Russians have come out and condemned the massacre. And it's going to be very interesting to see what their foreign minister decides to do in the next few days. I was very hopeful when the Chinese foreign minister went over about a month ago to talk with the regime, thinking that there would be some real concrete issues getting resolved. But unfortunately,
the Chinese have shown no balls in this. I mean, the Chinese are just pretty much... I mean, let's call it what it is. I mean, the Assad government is the last bastion
right.
of ally that they have, they being Russia and China, in the Middle East.
The strategic importance for them because of the port. And the Chinese have been very reluctant to get involved in other countries' domestic issues. That's always been their mantra, is to stay out of other countries' business. But that goes back to the whole issue of being a responsible stakeholder. At some point, you as a responsible international partner have to say, this is a genocide, and you have to take action. And slowly the Russians now are coming around, but it's sort of a little bit too late. I think everybody recognizes this is a massacre, this is a genocide, but we can't seem to get everybody on board to do the right thing and, number one, fund the opposition, number two, enact these sanctions that would be so crippling that it would force the government of Assad to step down.
Bob.
I think what Ralph said is very important in this sense. Russia, who has been the best friend that Syria's got.
Well, again, Syria is their last ally in the region.
And they are saying, in effect, you guys, Assad, your team, you're going too far. You're killing people. You're just killing people. And it's finally getting to the point where Assad really doesn't have anybody who will stand up for him and say, he's a good guy and we're going to be on his team. Nobody's there anymore. I think the Chinese are doing the way they normally do. They're pretty quiet and they don't talk a whole lot publicly. I was surprised how strong the Russian position was. But the fact that the Russians would basically say, hey, Assad, you are wrong and you are killing your own people and you got to stop it.
But it took literally a visit from the British foreign minister to go to Moscow to actually have them do a press conference to actually come out and condemn. It's almost like the Western world is going to Russia going, look, you want to be a player in the G8, you want to be a player in the G20,
yeah,
that's fine. You're going to have to come on board.
And don't forget WTO accession. That's
right.
A big issue for the Russians, right now.
You know, it's unfortunate maybe that Russia is, quote, late to the game. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, if they're coming in right now, they have made a major step in saying to Assad, hey, baby, you're wrong, and we're not going to back you anymore.
And both Russia and China have very strong anti-foreigner or U.S. Interests, so they do not want to be seen as kowtowing to the U.S. Agenda.
Well, let's talk about the U.S. agenda for a second, Al. I mean, it seems to me that we've done everything publicly in condemning this. It was reported today that the U.S. and seven other countries actually ousted the Syrian delegations from their embassies and exported them back to Syria. But is that enough? Are we on the brink of maybe another front in the Middle East?
I don't think we could afford another front in the Middle East.
But do we have a choice?
Yeah, well, I think... Look at it this way. If Syria was the only country in the world treating its people this way, we might be able to stretch it a little bit farther, our military and our budget and all the rest. But
whole bunch of countries in Africa are doing terrible things and have been for years to their people. And is it worse in Syria than it is in, and I wish I could name the countries, but there are
the
seven.
Sudan.
There are
the
seven.
Sudan.
The Sudan is a good example. And then you get into, are we the policemen of the world argument and or point of view, and we're in a very difficult position. It is an outrage what is going on in all those places, and something should be done in all those places. Can it be military in all those places? I think the answer is obviously not. So are we doing all we can internationally? And we seem to be gathering support.
Bob?
I think what Al says is very prescient. You know, obviously, the West, whatever you want to say, Western civilization, the countries, you know, you can't be every place. Right now, for reasons that are unique maybe to Syria, maybe because it's so publicly bad, you know, there's enough people watching it that it's become something that a whole lot of people know about. And at that point, even without a military force going in there, we probably won't have to do that.
But we saw genocide on an epic level in Darfur. We chose not to intervene. And yet the international community has been calling for us. The pictures coming out of Syria, I mean, literally, bound hands of children on TV, killed by, arguably, Syrian government tactics. That's not enough to at least strike an offensive position by the U.S. and our military to at least have some plan in place to intervene?
Well, and I think we were under a lot of criticism for not intervening. Previously to in Darfur and other countries in Africa where there has been genocide. The bottom line now is you're going to have to focus on regime change, and that's going to come down to be the willingness to fund the rebel groups. And how are you going to do that? I mean, can you get weapons and supplies into them to mount an effective campaign to get rid of Assad?
But Bob, I mean, we go off of what Ralph is saying. We talk about regime change. I mean, the American government has called for Assad to step aside numerous times. NATO, many of the members of the NATO, many NATO countries have called for Assad. The UN has publicly, the Arab League has called for Assad to step down. It does not seem that Assad is willing to step down. What is it going to take?
Well, I don't know what it's going to take, but I
Navy
will
see. SEALs. Yes.
But now we're talking about a military option,
right,
here, Al.
We're talking about assassination.
Yeah.
Which is illegal according to U.S. government law.
The fact
we did it to Bin Laden.
No. My guess is that it's not going to take military forces on the ground. I think Assad is now in such a situation with his only two international major friends backing away, and at least one of them, Russia, coming out and saying, Assad, you've got to stop this. I think it's going to be a situation where he will be so pushed that he will say to himself, the only way I'm going to save my wife and my kids' life is I got to go. This is going to, we can't survive anymore.
Eventually he'll just be squeezed too tight. And
yeah, it just he'll be squeezed to the point where, you know, he'll take a deal.
Which says, and I agree with Paul, which says that, one, from what I've said, and nobody's disagreed, I don't think we can do it militarily. We have to rely on diplomacy. Diplomacy is slow, and it often doesn't look like you're doing anything and what have you, but the forces, and we've elucidated them here, are gathering, so you've got Russia and China, and that may be the way we'll have to deal with all of these.
But here's the question I pose to everybody, and Bob, I'll go back to you on this, and Al, I'd like your thoughts on this as well. We saw what happened in Libya. where the Americans took a second-tier position, backing the French and backing NATO forces in the ousting of Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi by the Libyan rebels. Is that not maybe a blueprint for what we could do in allowing some of these other countries that are calling, i.e., Great Britain, France, Germany?
I think it might be. But I remember that we had a candidate for Congress that I don't know if you remember, Dakota something.
Yeah.
who was an Army colonel, and I can't remember whether he said it on this program or whether it was a discussion afterwards, but he said, those countries could not have done what they did if we, the United States, didn't have the military might we have, because we were providing a lot of support stuff that they were incapable of providing for themselves.
You're talking about Dakota Woods, the congressional candidate down in Oklahoma.
You're trying to get elected to Congress. Exactly. And that was something I didn't know. And I don't think that has been explained enough to the American public. And it is a way that we can participate without committing our troops, getting more American people killed, and stretching our military way beyond its breaking point. That's what's concerning.
There's an awful lot of things we can do without putting boots on the ground. We proved it in Libya. And it may come to it.
And our allies showed they were willing to play the game that way.
And look, remind yourself, the Arab League, you know, all the Arab nations are just, you know, they'd be happy to cut his head off, Assad's head off, if they could. And I think that, given the fact that the two nations on the Security Council, China and Russia, who have been the support within the UN and within the international community for Assad, have basically pulled away from him.
Carl, too.
I think he's gone.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think there's something wrong with my cell phone because I've been trying to break into the conversation. I wanted to say about 5 minutes ago or more that I think the same thing that happened with Libya will happen in this situation. Assad has gone too far. If Kofi Annan doesn't have anything good to say out of his meetings with Assad today, I think the diplomatic route is going to be used, and that the countries are going to get together, and especially now that Russia and China are not happy with what's going on, I think the move will be made in within a week, if not less.
Ralph?
I think if we can get Russia and China to abstain, certainly we can move forward in an operation similar to what happened in Libya. The added bonus is we'd be taking out a client state of Iran, which would be very, very important.
But are we looking at a situation here, Bob, where there could be a domino effect? I mean, I hate using that term because it was so horribly used during the Vietnam conflict. But is there a domino effect with Syria onto Iran, onto other maybe Muslim countries?
Obviously, there is some possibility of that. But, you know, Iran is Iran and Syria is Syria. And they're two different problems. Syria is busy killing its citizens in public. Iran is not doing that. But the amount of what do they call it, you know, all the stuff we're doing around Iran with respect to being able to sell. They're not even able to sell their oil right now. I mean, and that's the only money they have. So they're in deep doo-doo no matter what happens. But they're not killing their citizens. In Syria, they're shooting mothers and kids.
I mean,
that is a kind of a thing that gets people's attention real fast. And I think, quite frankly, that the Russians and the Chinese have decided that Assad is a losing deal. And if they want to be able to have any relationship with the next generation of leadership in Syria, they better, you know, get on the team of people who are saying, we got to get rid of Assad.
Yeah, they don't want to make the mistake mistake of when you have a new government come into Syria that they're going to be on the outs.
That's exactly right. I think you're exactly right, Ralph. I think that it's very close to that right now.
Yeah.
So I think we've been doing that with an awful lot of the Egyptians. Spring, not Egyptian spring.
The Arab Spring.
Because I think a lot of those countries are going to end up being controlled by people that are going to make life very difficult for us.
Well, you know, we're hearing reports coming out of eyewitnesses. One report that was quoted is they said that government forces came in and, quote, pulled out their guns and started spraying us. Which means that there's just a huge disregard for life by the Syrian forces. It's a tragic, tragic situation. Bottom line, round the horn, is there anything possible that the American government can do in the next 2 weeks that would help get Assad gone?
I'm sure there is. I have no idea what that is because I'm not on the inside. I suspect that there are a lot of people over in the State Department and in the Defense Department that are working on precisely that issue, and there's no doubt an answer to it. I don't have it.
Bob?
I think that Assad is gone. I don't know what the date is, but I would be willing to put a little bit of money on the fact that he won't be around by Labor Day.
Ralph?
I think the best thing the U.S. can do is to start funding the opposition as well as continue to push on the diplomatic front, and Assad will be gone.
And Carl?
I think the nations will come together and do a similar thing that they did in Libya, and it will end this battle.
Very good. All right.
And Assad will be gone, or one way or another, he'll be gone.
When we come back, we're going to have our final segment. We're going to talk a little bit about Christine Lagarde's little gap and what happened in Europe and tell me a story. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more time. One more once.
We're back here live from Shelley's Back Room. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio for our final segment. We're just reminiscing. Congressman Al talking about the time he interviewed Count Basie.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Count Basie was, if the word means anything, it could be defined as Count Basie, the word gentleman.
Wow.
He was a gentleman. He was patient. A whole bunch of local, very local people wanting to interview him, asking some of the stupidest questions you could imagine, all of which he answered truthfully without making them look like fools. And I asked a couple of those questions myself.
Good job. Emmy award-winning broadcast.
20 years old. He was wonderful.
Wow. We're going to quickly go into our last segment. We're going to talk about the little gap where Christine Lagarde put her PA into her bouche over the weekend. Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, has come out and said that basically Greece should be ousted, I guess. What was her exact quote?
Well, she called them tax dodgers, rampant tax dodgers.
Yeah, that to paraphrase,
yeah. An accurate statement.
Yeah. They're a little more than rampant tax dodgers.
Yeah.
She had more sympathy for poverty-stricken children in Niger rather than those in Greece facing the consequences of austerity, which has led to stringent cuts to salaries and pensions and 5 straight years of recession in Greece.
Now there are many. Now obviously the government in Athens has called for Christine Lagarde to step down as the head of the IMF.
That's what happens to any politician who tells the truth. Somebody's going to ask him to go away.
Yeah. Here's the issue. The tax evasion has been an issue in Greece, but the vast majority of Greeks do pay taxes through their paychecks and pensions. The bigger issue is that the Greeks, for years, have been trying to force the IMF and the Germans to renegotiate the terms. But finally, Christine Lagarde and the Germans are saying, no way, these are the conditions. You either abide by the conditions that we've set or you're out. And this comment that Lagarde made just reflects her anger and frustration with the Greeks' inability to compromise and to come to terms to dealing with the austerity situation.
Bob?
What I find amazing about the Greeks is that 75 or 80% of them want to stay in the euro, and 75 or 80% of them don't want to have the austerity program.
Right.
I mean, you can't have it both ways, and that's what Lagarde has been telling them since she became head of IMF.
You know, I have said this once before, but the last time the Greeks had a functioning government, Pericles was running it in 400 B.C.
Wow. Obviously you as a Democrat, you're not a fan of austerity measures. However, are the Greeks out of bounds on this one?
Sure they are.
Yeah.
And I am less opposed to austerity measures in, for example, our current situation than I would have been when we were really flush and we didn't have troops all over the world that were costing us money and so forth and so on. No,
if I were in Congress today, I would be looking very carefully at spending cuts. I would be demanding tax increases.
Which would not get you necessarily reelected.
That wouldn't get me reelected. And probably, I would favor enough spending cuts, but that wouldn't help me get reelected either. But I would oppose some that I think are draconian that the conservatives are proposing, and whether I could sell that back home as enough, I have no idea.
Reality is that what Al is saying is 100% true. The situation in this country is that the people who want cuts don't want any revenues. The people who want revenues don't want any cuts. I mean, it's just insane, and we're going to have to figure this out. We're lucky. I mean, we are in the same boat in one sense that the Greeks are. We want it both ways.
But we say that as we sit in a cigar bar drinking our $12 glasses of Merlot and smoking our $8 cigars.
Well, but it's also true that the guys who are smoking more expensive cigars and drinking better wine up on Capitol Hill are even worse. And it's their job, and they're not doing it.
Well, here's what Lagarde had. Her comments could play well into the election campaign of the leftist parties like Sirica, which came in a surprising second in on May 6th. And that party was promising to end the austerity, but now they're running neck and neck for first place with the conservative New Democracy Party. If Sirica again defies the odds and is able to get enough support to form a government, Greece could then be forced to leave the Eurozone.
Well,
so this is going to be interesting and heady stuff. Right now in Europe, you have two competing philosophies. You have one group that wants more government spending and higher taxes. Then you have the other group, which is Canada, Germany, Sweden, and Israel, which has decided to focus on reducing deficit and deal with pro-growth policies. Which side is going to win? We just don't know, especially with the election of Hollande in France.
Well, I'll tell you right now, Christine Lagarde, I mean, you know, she definitely called it like she saw it. You got to give her credit for that.
I do. I support what she said. I just wish she could have said in a different way so as not to galvanize the leftist party.
Well, we'll see how that plays out. Now it's time for my favorite part of the discussion. It's my favorite thing. It's Tell Me a Story. When we talk about all the buzz, innuendo, rumor that we talk about, we know that the major media outlets are out there listening because they usually report on what we talk about anyways after the fact. I'm going to start with Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
I think I said it a little bit earlier, but in my judgment, Mr. Assad will not be the president of Syria on Labor Day. I think in the next several months, the fact that his only friends, the Chinese and the Russians, are backing off, and clearly what they're saying in public, I can't imagine how serious and vigorous they're saying the same thing and even more so to Assad himself. I think he's going to be gone, and I think we're going to have a situation there in Syria like we have in Egypt and some other countries. As they try to figure out what to do, we don't know who's going to be in charge, but we know one thing, he's gone.
Carl Tubin, tell me a story.
Well, I really don't have a story, but I just want to do a reminiscent Al Swift. Sometime in the 50s, I was a senior in high school. I went up to New York to visit a friend of mine who was out at a party and said, you know, don't come to my parents' apartment until 10:30, 11 o'clock. So I got up to New York, and there was a place called Basin Street. It was a nightclub that you walked down the steps and got in, and et cetera. Somehow or other, I must have looked 21, although I only drank Coke that night, and Count Basie was playing opposite George Shearing. And I sat for 3.5 hours listening to both, and Count Basie became a very favorite of mine. Both of them became a favorite of mine. Throughout their careers, 50s, 60s, 70s, whatever.
Wow, good story. Congressman Al, tell me a story.
Two of the greatest, Carl, two of the greatest. I never had a chance to talk with George Shearing, but I did with Basie. I've forgotten my story because I was interrupted, and come back to me because I had one.
Okay, well, I have a story. The Federal Elections Commission right now is under pressure to clean its act up. The FEC has got several things on its docket related to the issue of electioneering and coordination. You're going to see the FEC more than likely start enforcing the laws more to the letter than they have been in previous years. There are a couple of cases, one out of Oklahoma, one out of Texas, one out of Michigan, where they are literally calling into question the use of corporate resources, the use of corporate funding as related to election coordination and electioneering. Watch some of the decisions in the rulings and some of the investigations. There's a couple of outstanding investigations there. They're going to be big. Al.
My story is because I was chairman of the committee that had jurisdiction over the FEC. The FEC was structured to be bipartisan, literally, equal numbers. And both parties have worked to see that their three members of that are loyal Republicans or Democrats. In short, it was set up because Congress was terribly afraid, I think rightfully so, that one party or the other would start making all these decisions on a partisan basis and against them. But they had created a basically dysfunctional institution, and then it's being criticized for being dysfunctional. It was created to be dysfunctional, and I doubt very seriously that a lot is going to come out of the things that you referred to.
But there's been a lot of pressure, there's been a lot of media attention drawn on some of the electioneering and some of the funding, as well as some of the issues as far as using corporate resources.
I had a congressman from Michigan who would come to me and just complain terribly about the fact that they wouldn't make this his way. He happened to be a Democrat. And so he hated the FEC. And I said, well, you really want a situation in which the Republicans would control it? Well, heavens no. Well, then what is your solution? I think it's very difficult to come up with a panel, a government panel, that will do what the FEC is required to do or is charged with doing and not have to have it hobbled by the fact that it's got to be neutral from a partisan standpoint.
Wow, interesting. Okay. Ralph, tell me a story.
I'll go out on a limb and say Greece will leave the euro by the end of the year, and this will have major ramifications for the future of the eurozone.
Oh my God! If the Greeks pull out of the euro, the financial crisis that would create. You're talking about a drachma that's maybe half the value of the euro. You're talking about defaults on bank loans. Ah, good Lord.
In France, Hollande is not supportive of austerity. So
wow, interesting. Real quickly, I do want to take a moment real quick. Over this past weekend, obviously, we had Memorial Day celebrations and Memorial Day services here in Washington, D.C. and across the country, parades and barbecues and everything like that. A little bit of a commentary on my point, a little editorial point. Memorial Day has kind of lost its meaning. There's a lot, you know, people look at it as a day of barbecues, going out to the beaches, the lakes, etc., hanging out with family, having barbecues, parades, and everything. The reality is, what started as Decoration Day and has become Memorial Day needs to go back to its focus. We take for granted sometimes our military. We take for granted the fact that it is an all-volunteer military, and that these people volunteer to put their lives on the line for the defense of our Constitution, for the defense of our rights as Americans, and defense of our national interests. And we don't pay them a lot. They do it because they want to do it. And the only reason why I bring this up is, we're pulling out of Iraq. We've got a lot of veterans coming home. We need to take care of our veterans. We need to make sure that our veterans find jobs that they integrate back in with our community. They have a lot of positive traits and a lot of positive qualifications that can be used in the private sector, and we just don't tap into that enough. So as we go forward from today on, just if you see a veteran, thank them. If you have a veteran in your family, give them a hug and just tell them we really appreciate all that they do. If we don't take care of our overtaxed military right now, we're going to lose this great experiment that we have called America. So just keep that in mind and just say a prayer for those that are out there defending our national interests. On behalf of...
Can I add something real fast?
Yeah.
I had to go to Baltimore to dedicate a plaque to my late wife, and the rabbi in his sermon on Shabbat yesterday spoke about the same subject, number one. Number two, yesterday, for the first time in the history of the wall, the president gave a speech at not only at Arlington, but at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And he laid it on the line what we have to do for not only the Vietnam veterans, but for all veterans. And it was a very, very good speech.
Right. Well, you know, again, this one's kind of personal. This one's personal to me, being a veteran myself, although my service seems insignificant to the sacrifices that some have made, the ultimate sacrifice. My sister and my brother-in-law are both in the military. I have two nephews that are looking to go into the military. I just thank them. That's all they ask. Just thank them. On behalf of Congressman Al, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, Alan Moore, congratulations on your recent nuptials. Carl Tubin. On behalf of Carl Tubin, forgot Carl was. On behalf of all of us, say our background politics. To our veterans, we say thank you. To our loyal listeners, we'll see you back here next week on Blog Talk Radio Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
The place to be.
Absolutely, Bob. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us. And, oh, by the way, you can like us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to blogtalkradio.com/backroompolitics and follow Backroom Politics. Thanks again.